Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is Thursday, April 4th. This is host Richard Benulli. Today we have returning guest Charles Hughes Smith. Charles is author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and a radically beneficial world, automation, technology, and creating jobs for all, resistance, revolution, liberation, a model for positive change, the nearly free university and the emerging economy, pathfinding our destiny, preventing the final fall of our democratic republic, and will you be richer or poorer? And also, global crisis, national renewal, a revolutionary grand strategy for the United States. His blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. He now has a Substack, charleshughesmith.substack.com. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. Well, I'm looking forward to discussing our topic of today's podcast. The four themes that I outlined in a blog post that you felt were worthy of discussion.
Yeah, that was a great blog post. And so there's four themes that you see currently in progress. And to what length of time do you see these lasting? Multiple years.
Yeah, that's a great introduction to the ideas, Richard. Because I'm proposing or suggesting that these themes are systemic or structural. In other words, that they are built into the fundamental structures of our economy and society, and so they cannot be resolved with some kind of simple reform or a new technology. And so I see them as playing out over the next 10 to 20 years, as opposed to they're long term, not short term.
I see. And those four themes specifically are sclerosis, dysfunction, debt saturation, and wealth power asymmetry. Could you elaborate on each one?
Yeah, thank you, Richard. And I should probably explain that I wrote this post in response to a Wall Street investment bank, which had released a research paper that was saying there that the three themes they saw being most important over the next decade were AI, of course, decarbonization, which is a fancy way of saying the transition to a non-carbon energy foundation, and longevity, human longevity, humans living longer. And so these are all based on technology, essentially, right? AI, of course, and then green energy, however you want to describe it, is a form of technology. And then longevity is the result of medical technology advances. So all of that's good, and we can hope for those advances, but they don't fix what's actually broken. And in our society, and I would say the global society, what we're seeing is a massive decline in public health, the health of the individuals. 70% of Americans are obese or overweight and at risk of metabolic disorders. There's severe mental health issues that are not being addressed. On a larger economic scale, the general sense of financial insecurity is a reality for, say, the bottom 80% of American households, that they can no longer count on having a secure financial future. And so, and then on the national scale, we see like a tremendous rise in our dependence on debt to finance our consumption in the moment, right? Present consumption. And so all of these things are problems that technology is not going to solve. They're going to need like a social political type of solution. So that's why I picked these four. So sclerosis is my term for the way that our political social system is incapable of responding in a coherent, innovative fashion to these kinds of social problems I've mentioned. And so the core of sclerosis, in my view, is the power elites that run that really have the most influence on our economy and political structure. They like things exactly the way they are because they're the ones who are benefiting from the structures that are in place. So they're not interested in allowing society or the economy to evolve or adapt, except if it benefits them. And so that's like kind of taking an ecosystem and saying, well, you're only allowed to adapt if it benefits us. And that's not adaptation or evolution. You know, evolution has to be free. And so the ideal is a free flow of information, experimentation, and so on. And so if elites and cartels and an authoritarian state and monopolies control the vast majority of our economy and society, then you're going to get sclerosis because you've basically had your ability to adapt and evolve choked off. So I would say that as an example of sclerosis, one example would be the fact that we're still dependent on Federal Reserve manipulation of the credit markets and basically printing money in the trillions. We basically solved nothing that was the source of the 2008-2009 global financial crisis. And so we sort of just play along like we fixed everything, but actually all we've done is just do more of what's failed, if you will. So, and there are many other examples of sclerosis where local, like cities or counties, don't really solve things like homelessness. You know, they sort of dabble in it and throw money at it, but they don't really solve anything. And so those are examples of sclerosis. And you might be able to add some of your own.
And remember we did a podcast on regulatory capture. So that would be, I think, a great example of this. Would you agree, like the idea that, there's donations provided to politicians by large corporations that want to keep in power in terms of their corporate structure and stature in the economy. So they provide donations to politicians to help them get elected, as long as they're willing to sign legislation that the corporations come up with. And the way it's written, the legislative verbiage is a way that helps them, that the corporation, that specific corporation, to stay in power. Preventing small new entrants, like maybe somebody from university has a good idea on establishing an innovative new company to compete with a large existing corporation, but they're just not given a chance, right? Because of this legislation, which becomes a regulation in law, and it's written in a way that prevents the new entrants from competing. Your thoughts, Charles, on that?
Yeah, that's an excellent example, Richard. And along that same line, we can also mention what I call complexity thickets, that when the regulations get so complex, only major corporations and agencies can manage the compliance and all the other issues of that regulation. So no matter what the regulation might be or what its intention is, when it becomes so complicated that only major institutions and corporations can manage to comply with those regulations, then you have sclerosis. The second point was dysfunction. And of course, there's many examples of this. And I have to mention Cory Doctorow, the writer who uses the term, and pardon the language, but he uses the term enshittification, to describe what's happening to so many products and services. I would call it the crapification. But we all know that things simply don't work as well. They're not as durable. And when services break down, it's hard to get somebody to fix it. Another form of dysfunction, which ties into the regulatory problem you mentioned, is to get a building permit, you know, which used to be quite straightforward. And I know this because I used to be a building contractor 40 years ago. And so now it's become this multi-month or possibly even multi-year, a nightmarish process, which is not really adding to public safety, because what it does unintentionally, perhaps, is it creates a huge incentive for people to not even bother getting a building permit because the process is so tedious, slow, and expensive. So then you're getting projects built that don't get inspected at all. And so this is that's to me a prime example of dysfunction. And maybe you can add to that.
Yeah, certainly the result of the regulatory capture we just talked about then results right in the dysfunction in society and in the economy and the economic structure. But yeah, overall, I agree with your many examples.
Yeah, and so then the third point is debt saturation, which is just a way of saying that income, whatever the income is, can only support so much debt, because the income, of course, is also paying for expenses. And so once an individual or household, a local government or a federal government or a corporation, regardless of the entity, once that they're in all the available income is already going to debt service, then it's impossible to borrow more. Now, and the game that the game that's been played for decades is, oh well, the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates so you can refinance all your gigantic debt at a lower rate of interest, and then that frees up income so you can go borrow more. But that whole kind of game breaks down when interest rates start rising, as they have recently. And so there's a point at which we can talk about all these wonderful things, AI and decarbonization and longevity and all this. All of that takes huge amounts of capital invested and with an uncertain return, by the way. There's no guarantees that any of that stuff's going to work. And so where is all this capital going to come from? Well, if inflation is eating up the purchasing power of currencies, and so people, individuals, households, corporations, etc., are having to pay more of their income, devote more of their income just to expenses because expenses are rising, and then they've borrowed and they keep borrowing, so their debt service rises. Well, then where's the capital going to come from? And so there's also these sort of limits built in. Like right now we see in the household, we see YOLO spending, right? You only live once. So go ahead and rack up your credit card, max out your credit card, take that vacation, go see that performance, et cetera, et cetera. But once your credit card's maxed out and your income is all accounted for, then you can't do that anymore. You reach a limit. And of course, this is sort of a squishy barrier when it becomes a federal government that can basically print money or continue to sell bonds like the United States government. But even that has limits, because once you're spending a large percentage of your tax revenues on interest, then it means that your other spending is going to get crimped. And so you can say, well, we can always borrow more. And it's like, but then you're going to end up with less revenues available for everything else that you want to do in your life. And so this debt saturation is a way of saying there are limits that we're fast approaching or have already hit across the entire spectrum of public and private borrowing. And so that is going to crimp either the amount of capital that's available to invest in all these wonderful things we want to see happen, or spending. In other words, there's just going to be less money available for consumption. So, and either of those would be detrimental to the economy.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree. Both at the public level and the private level on debt saturation. The idea that, once the servicing costs become overwhelming, there's not really much you can do, much in terms of, spending or whether it be discretionary or non-discretionary, and there's not really much extra income that can be spent, if at all. And the idea on the public side of green energy, the question is, where are you going to get the money? If it's financed by government, where are they going to get the money if there's debt saturation? And that's especially where the U.S. is in the indebted Western world. So that being U.S., Canada, Western Europe, U.K., Australia, New Zealand, essentially these countries that have been borrowing since World War II, no intention to repay back. Yes, between 2008 up till 2020, there was a lowering of interest rates, allowing, increasing levels of debt to be piled up. But then once interest rates have gone down to zero or even negative, as in Europe since 2014, it's just a matter of time before this debt saturation problem kicks in. And we saw that with the freezing up of the repo market. That is sort of the canary in the coal mine, that once the interest rates percolate on that, which they did, 2019, 2020, going up to 10% for short periods of time before the Fed had to keep bailing it out. You've reached debt saturation at that point in time. And so this is a big problem. And now with the U.S. Situation is essentially getting, it's almost like somebody with a job getting paid $4,000 per month, right? $4 trillion in collections, $4 trillion. So let's say you're making $4,000 a month, but you're spending $6,000 a month, your expenses, and the payment on the minimum payment on your credit card is $1,000 a month. So out of your $4,000 a month income, you've got to pay right off the bat $1,000 a month just to make the minimum payments on the credit card. But you still need to borrow another, $2,000 to get the $6,000 that you're spending, right? So the debt is increasing faster and faster at the same time that you can barely make the minimum payments on the credit card. So that's not likely to lead to a good outcome.
Absolutely. In fact, I just I saw a research paper that someone had run many scenarios for projecting what would happen to federal debt. And virtually no chance that there's a positive outcome, on the current trajectory. So absolutely right, Richard, a good example. And so the what I call wealth power asymmetry, we call it inequality, but I use the word asymmetry to suggest it's just how out of balance it's become. And I'll give an example because I live in Hawaii, but you could use the same example in any globalized economy where global capital can come in and buy land, businesses, and political influence. And so, say in the past generations, wealthy people would come to Hawaii or another tropical, island, paradise, and they would buy up, some very desirable, costly property on the beach or shoreline, right, for their mansion. And you go, okay, you know, they're going to pay higher taxes on that. And we can see it as a benefit, perhaps, you know, in some ways that they're going to pay higher property taxes and so on for their mansion. But that's not what we have now. Now we have Mark Zuckerberg buying huge swaths of the island of Kauai and not really having, not being pushed via the public authorities to detail what in fact he's planning to do with all this land. And of course, once you start acquiring huge chunks of scarce land, then you become powerful in a way. It's not just having a mansion on the beach, right? And so we see countless examples of this in the U.S. and around the world. You know, there's Bill Gates, you know, buying up huge swaths of farmland. And so this dominance of like tremendous wealth, of course, translates into political power. And it also is also social power. So, for example, what happens in places were fairly rural or fairly remote, like places in Idaho, for example, where as all this new money that's been created by global financialization pours in, then houses that used to cost $150,000 are now $700,000, and so local people can't possibly afford that. And that's certainly the case in Hawaii. And so a lot of people that grew up in Hawaii are moving to Las Vegas because it's the only place that they can both get a job and afford a house. And so this is disrupting, or I would say causing decay on social level in many ways. And to cite another well-known example, you know, in China, there's these sayings, these phrases that have become popular among youth. One is lying flat, and it's a Chinese term for basically abandoning the ambition to make it in China by working, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. And the reason why this is becoming a popular concept is that the opportunities to get ahead are now very restricted, in the sense that trying to buy a property, a home, is really out of reach. And the same is true in the United States as well. And so the other Chinese phrase that we've heard is let it rot. And in other words, like, let the system rot, because the system's not working for us anymore. And so that is the result, I think, very directly, of wealth power asymmetry. You know, that the agency that people have over their lives, their opportunities have been restricted and limited by the aggregation of and concentration of power and wealth in the hands of the few. And so, you know, what do you think of a society? What kind of future does a society have where the bottom half of the households own like 2% of the financial wealth? Those are the numbers in the United States. You know, 130 million households, 65 million households own less than about 2%, might be 2.4% of all financial wealth. Well, I don't think you're going to have a healthy society, because the ladder that used to exist for social mobility and to improve your lot in life, the rungs have been broken in so many ways. Like, now it's unaffordable to go to college. It's unaffordable to start a business. It's unaffordable to be self-employed. I mean, on and on and on. And so this is the kind of social decay that I'm talking about, is a direct result of this financialization, which then creates this tremendous wealth power asymmetry.
Yeah, exactly. And it could also mean you have issues at an international global scale, as you referred to Bill Gates, you know, whatever agenda he wants from even a social perspective, with his influence on large donations like to the World Health organization, you know, he's able to influence the policy at the World Health Organization, and to the point now where there's these amendments that are coming out, which would be instituted within the World Health Organization, accepted by all UN countries, that would need to be followed at the expense of the sovereignty of even your own country.
Precisely. Yeah. When there's that much wealth concentrated in the hands of the few that they can actually influence global policy, and override, if you will, national interests. I want to mention real quickly this whole idea that financialization is the source of this, of our dysfunction and social decay. And this is kind of ties into a school of thought that was founded by Fernand Braudel, the French historian, and other writers have picked up on that and built on the idea that that every empire, or the term is hegemon, every empire or powerful nation state goes through period, a cycle, and you know, you and I have often discussed cycles. This idea is that when you're on the rise, and you're dealing with production, in other words, you're producing goods and services, and directly, and then your decay starts when you substitute financialization for production. And so it's very easy to look at, say, the United States, and see how production has been offshored in order to, you know, improve profit margins, never mind the effects on the nation or the decay in quality. And so, and then financialization is now the answer for everything, right? So when we have a crisis, the idea is we drop interest rates to zero and we increase debt and there's the wealth effect and we're printing another $4 trillion. And so all of these, and this rise of financialization is in direct proportion to the decay of productive investing. And so instead we have this sort of speculative frenzy of like 0-day option expiration, that kind of thing. And that's not a healthy, I don't think you're going to build a society based on financialization and speculation. That's going to be as healthy and sustainable as a society built on improving productivity. And so that's the larger point.
Yeah, absolutely. At some point, you need to actually produce something. You know, this whole mostly like in the currently indebted Western world has been relying on a sort of debt-driven, financialized economy, and you know, with some issues involving geopolitical risks and assets that are you know, even being confiscated at different levels with different governments, depending on who you are. You know, the rule of law and property rights have been eroded away to the point now where the whole financialization cycle may be stopping, right? In the indebted Western world, the Chinese appear to be not only not buying additional bonds to lower their currency, so products at Walmart can be plentifully and cheaply available, but you know, they're selling what they have. So there's a double whammy happening: no longer buying new debt, rollover debt, but also selling existing debt. So it's a really a dire situation at the moment.
Yeah, and so I guess to my sort of ending summary of these four themes that we're discussing is that if you're unable, because of this social decay and the concentration of wealth and the reliance on basically what we call financial trickery, then you can enter a death spiral, because in which you keep doing more of what's actually creating your problems, and you do more of that because you've convinced yourself that that's the solution. And so we see that debt is a good example of that. Like, well, let's just borrow our way to prosperity, right? Or kind of like saying, let's borrow our way out of debt. That's a death spiral. And I think that you can say that sclerosis, dysfunction, debt saturation, and wealth power asymmetry are all aspects of a death spiral where, you know, the society, the culture, and the leadership, the political leadership, is simply incapable of breaking out of just doing more of what's creating the death spiral.
Yeah.
And you know, this series is more of a focus on the 2032 vision that we're putting together, different elements, different systems, what makes sense. So what would you recommend as the, you know, the 2032 vision to, you know, would that be, you know, looking at economic growth and limiting it to be debt-based or financialized, with more of an emphasis on globally competitive industries fostered by an educational, you know, system, educated populace, with more level-headed systems in place, you know, less of these power symmetries and less regulatory capture we've talked about. What are your thoughts, Charles?
Yeah, well, Richard, I would say that there's, in my view, there's two levels. One is, what can we do as individuals and households and communities? And of course, my idea is it's to increase our self-reliance. In other words, to take control of your own labor, your own resources that you own, and rely to the least degree possible on global supply chains and, national interventions, if you will. In other words, do more for yourself and control what you're investing in to the greatest degree possible, so that you're not just totally dependent on what happens on the global supply chain side. Now, that's not saying that it's possible to like live without the energy manufactured goods, but it's a way of saying that do what we can to limit our exposure to that risk. And then on the other side would be policy changes or reforms. And again, anything that decentralizes capital and political control is a positive to me, because I think if you look at the global economy as a ecosystem, it has a lot of moving parts. And so to think that some small group of people in one class of society can discern an answer that works for everybody, that's just not plausible. And so there may have to be 1,000 different solutions for 1,000 different communities in around the planet, or 10,000. And so the more that we can localize or relocalize capital and control, the more likely it is, I think, that we will find solutions that then we can share with others in the same or similar circumstances. But anything that it broadens how we can respond is a way of improving our adaptability. And that, of course, is the opposite of an authoritarian central state pushing solutions down everybody's throat, even when the solutions are making everything worse. So I would say, relocalize self-reliance and look for solutions that we can share, you know, using the technologies that we have.
Absolutely. And you've written about that in your books, and that's what we're doing also in this series, mentioning a lot of those type of solutions. Well, those were great words of wisdom and a grand strategy. Thanks very much for your insight. As always, Charles, how can our listeners and viewers learn more about your work?
Yeah, thank you, Richard. Visit me at oftwominds.com, or as Richard mentioned, visit me at Charles Hugh Smith on Substack. Thank you, Richard.
Great. Thank you, Charles.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.